भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येम क्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गेस्तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धस्सवाः स्वस्ति न पूषा विषवेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षिवरिष्ठनेमि स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति। Now this is a very important class for several reasons. One reason is that this is perhaps the last class on this particular text, because after this class we will have no class on Friday in the Old Temple till March 14, 2014, because I will be away. So on March 14, perhaps we will start another text. So this text we will conclude today. So I would say something about the order, the text, and its place in world thoughts. I already explained at the very beginning that this work, Gaudapada Karika, was written in the 6th century AD. You have to think of the age of St. Augustine, maybe about 100 years or 80 years after St. Augustine's time. The book plays, it occupies a very important place in the history of the evolution of Indian philosophy, because this is the first systematic exposition of non-dualistic philosophy in modern times. Please remember, this is not the beginning of non-dualism or Advaita philosophical tradition, but this was a landmark work. It is a turning point in the history of Vedantic thoughts, Eastern philosophical tradition. The work itself, as I said earlier, was called Gaudapada Karika. Gaudapada is the name of the author who lived in 6th century AD. Karika is a technical work, it's a commentary on a shorter technical work written not in prose but in verse. So it is a commentary in verse. The author is a very important figure in India's philosophical tradition. As many of you may have heard, Indian philosophy as we find it today has got an almost an unbroken succession of traditional teachers who handed over this philosophical tradition from generation to generation of students and teachers, beginning with, say, around 3rd millennium BC, that means almost for 5,000 years. For example, in the last class we dealt with Sankhya philosophy attributed to Kapila. Kapila is said to have lived around 3rd millennium BC. And Vedantic tradition is even more older. In this tradition, there is one central figure who, for the first time, built up the entire edifice of Vedanta philosophy as a compact, well-defined metaphysical system. His name was Shankaracharya, who lived around 150 years after the period of a present author, Gaudapada. So there is an ancient verse which gives a list of the great teachers in Vedantic tradition and also gives an idea of the succession of teachers right from early prehistoric times onwards. That verse I shall read, it's very important to remember the succession, the tradition of Vedanta philosophy as we understand it today. To appreciate this antiquity and this unbroken spiritual succession, you can read Swami Vivekananda's works. As most of you know, Swamiji came to America in 1893 to attend a parliament of religions, and there he gave a most wonderful, rational, and scientific exposition of Vedantic thought. And that was the beginning of the flow of Eastern wisdom to Western world. In fact, Vivekananda was some kind of a bridge between the East and West. And today, if you walk in the streets of San Francisco, if you find yoga studios, if you find people practicing yoga, if you find people practicing Zen meditation, Buddhism, or any kind of Eastern religious metaphysical system, it's all because Swami Vivekananda opened the royal highway and a succession of great teachers followed the path which he inaugurated, which he opened up in 1893. The Buddhism is academically studied as a separate branch of thought. Its source is the Upanishads, which Swami Vivekananda taught in Western world. So from that time onwards, you find a constant succession of different meditation techniques, philosophical traditions, spiritual traditions, flowing towards the Western world, the Occidental world, from the Orient. Now, if you read Swami Vivekananda's complete works, and if you read his earlier lectures in the Parliament of Religions, starting with the inaugural address, in September 11, 1893. And if you go through the succeeding presentations like paper on Hinduism and so on, why we disagree, all these important, well-known talks, you find Swami Vivekananda never mentions the name of his guru. He never mentions Siddhamakrishna. But if you read Vivekananda's life and teachings, Swamiji says, I am an instrument in my master's hands. Vivekananda himself says, I have not taught anything. I am just an instrument in my master's hands. And his master was Siddhamakrishna Paramahamsa. But in his talks and lectures, especially in Western world, he very rarely mentions Siddhamakrishna. And later on, he stressed again and again. He repeatedly asserted, I have taught nothing but the Upanishads. Vivekananda says again and again, I have taught nothing but the Upanishads. So you can see this, this apparent contradiction. Swami Vivekananda, who considered himself to be a humble disciple and prophet, heralder, evangelist of Siddhamakrishna Paramahamsa, rarely mentions Siddhamakrishna's names in his earlier lectures. And later he asserted, I have taught nothing but the Upanishads. What he did was, first he taught the universal spiritual teachings of the Upanishads, Vedanta. And then he presented Siddhamakrishna's teachings and life as the best demonstration, illustration of the teachings of Vedanta. So he first presented the universal teachings of Vedanta and Upanishads, which is part of a long, ageless, ancient tradition. And then after presenting these universal Vedanta teachings, he presents Siddhamakrishna later on as the best illustration of these Vedantic teachings in modern times. So people were very much fascinated. Now, Swami Vivekananda said again and again that Vedanta doesn't begin with one individual. Vedanta is eternal, ageless, a philosophical, spiritual tradition, which comes down to us from the ancient teachers. And Sri Ramakrishna and Vivekananda are the modern teachers, exponents, prophets of the Vedantic tradition. So you have to remember, it begins not with an individual, it is an ancient tradition. But still, there is a well-accepted succession of teachers mentioned, this succession is mentioned in a beautiful verse, which is chanted at the beginning of any discussion Vedanta in scholarly circles in India. The verse I shall chant, and then I shall explain. That will give us an idea of the antiquity and the spiritual tradition of Vedanta. Now, we do not have any clear-cut, unbroken succession of teachers mentioned in any books, right from, see, Thales, who lived the 7th century. He was the most celebrated Greek philosopher who lived in 7th century BC, who lived even before Buddha. But we do not have an unbroken succession, what in Sanskrit is called parampara, an unbroken succession of teachers, students, and their students, and like that, an unbroken succession of teachers. We do not have such a tradition in Western philosophical tradition. If at all we had, it came to an end almost with Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, Plotinus and Philo. But in Vedanta, there is an unbroken succession of the great saints and sages who taught this universal wisdom, which Vivekananda brought to this country in the later half of the last decade of 19th century. Sorry, in the earlier half. He brought it here in 1893. So in the former half of the last decade of 19th century. Now, where does this tradition come from? What we were discussing in these classes. Where is the original source? Where is it coming from? As I said, it is eternal. Still, there is a succession of teachers mentioned. This is the verse. Narayanam Padmabhuvam Vasishtham Shaktim Cha Tat Putra Parasharam Cha Vyasam Shukam Gaudapadam Mahantam Govinda Yogindra Matasya Shishyam Sri Shankaracharya Madhasya Padma Padam Cha Hastam Alagam Cha Shishyam Tam Todagam Vartika Karam Anyan Asmat Gurun Santadam Anatosmi. This is the famous verse. It gives a very simple verse. The verse says, this philosophical tradition begins with God. So to indicate, to denote, to clearly express the fact, it is eternal. It is not a man-made system of thought like Marxist philosophy of Karl Marx or Engels or German idealism of Kant or utilitarianism of J.S. Mill or Bentham. Nothing like that. So it begins with God himself. Narayana is not a name of a particular person. It denotes the eternal spiritual reality, the eternal spiritual principle. And then from that eternal spiritual principle, from God, a few important figures who represent different stages in the evolution of Vedantic philosophy is mentioned here. So then Brahma, Vasishtha, Shakti, Parashara, Vyasa, Shuka, etc. All these great teachers are mentioned. And then after mentioning Shuka, last time in the last class we mentioned the great teacher of Bhagavata Purana when Parikshit asked the question, death is staring at my face, what should I do, whom should I meditate? how I should lead the rest of my life. I have got only 7 days to live. I mentioned this story. And then in response to this question, the great sage Shuka gave an answer. That answer we can get in the form of the great devotional classic Bhagavata Purana. That Shuka is mentioned here. He's one of the great teachers. And then Gaudapada. Gaudapada is the author of this work. Gaudapada's disciple was Govinda Bhagavatpada. And Govinda Bhagavatpada's Shishya disciple was Shankaracharya. So Shankaracharya occupied the central position. Before that, there were several teachers. And after him also, there are several teachers. And then where is the last link? The last link is our own teacher. Asmad Gurun Santatamanatosmi. Asmad Gurun is my own teachers. So starting from the eternal reality, Brahman or Atman, or God himself, this eternal spiritual tradition, as a flow, has come down to us, like the river flowing from the high mountains, flowing for thousands of miles before it joins the ocean. Like that, this tradition, eternal tradition, it doesn't end with us, but it has come to us through this succession of teachers and students. This is mentioned here. Among those great teachers, Gaudapada's name is mentioned. That is an important principle to remember. Now, that's why great teachers like Shankaracharya has mentioned this great philosopher's name, Gaudapada's name, Atroktam Vedantartha Sampradaya Vidbhihi Acharyehi Anadimaya Supta, etc. It means, Shankaracharya mentions, so as I said earlier, these great teachers who knew the philosophical spiritual tradition of eternal truth have come down to us. Now, now I would say something concerning this book. I already said at the very beginning, one uniqueness of this book is that it analyzes the supreme reality in the light of our everyday experiences. That's why it's so very logical. The totality of our experiences spread over three states of consciousness: the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. What we experience in waking state, we do not see in dreams. What we see in dreams and waking states, we do not experience in deep sleep state. But at the same time, our dreams are influenced by the experiences and tendencies that we have gathered in waking state. You can never have a dream which is completely separated, which is completely detached, divorced, entirely cut off, distinct and different from your waking state experiences. But your waking state experiences are different from dream state. In waking state, it takes 5 hours for you to reach New York from here, 6 hours. But in dream state, in split second, our mind travels 3,500 miles. While in waking state, we are walking in the streets of San Francisco. When we dream, we feel we have reached Russia or China or some other. Our mind has traveled thousands of miles. So, and again, waking experiences are somewhat gross in nature. Dream experiences are somewhat subtle, because in waking state, experiences are related to the 5 senses of perception and mind. We see something when our eyes and mind come together. We hear something when ears and mind come together. We can touch something only when the sense of touch and mind come together. So there is a grossness about experiences of waking state. But in dream state, all this happened at a subtle level. Everything is a projection of the mind. You are sleeping. It's pitch dark everywhere. You are sleeping in a small room with eyes closed, and you see yourself walking under the burning sun in a desert, you'd see a huge truck moving. But you are in a small room, but you find yourself seeing a huge truck moving, or you see yourself riding an elephant. All these examples you find. So, in dream state, everything is subtle. But then, this difference is there. But there is also another fact to be remembered. Your dream experiences can never be completely different from waking state experiences. Because what we gather in waking state become subtle tendencies and impressions, remain in the mind, and they come to the surface in dreams. And these experiences of waking state are relived, re-experienced in dreams. But everything happens at the mental level. Your five senses of perception are inactive. Your five senses of action are inactive. Only mind is projecting different images, like in the film. So, Gaudapada says, waking state and dream state are different. But in deep sleep, you don't see anything. Everything is merged in a thick veil of ignorance or darkness. Now Gaudapada says, there is a difference with regard to what is seen, what is experienced in the three states of experiences. But there is no difference at all with regard to the one who sees, the one who experiences, the one who goes through all these experiences. That's why when we wake up from dream, we are able to remember what we dreamed. So, the dreamer is the same person as the one who was experiencing things in waking state. The same reality. And when you go to deep sleep state, you don't see anything. There is no experiencer, active experiencer. But that experiencer is present there. That's why when we come back to the waking state after a complete, a restful, deep sleep, we are able to experience the joy, the restfulness, the relaxation that accompany the state of deep sleep. I had a wonderful rest. I had a wonderful deep sleep. So the experiencer is the same. In Sanskrit, it's called drashta, the subject. But what is experienced is different. Drishyam, it's called what is experienced, what is seen. The objects are different. Now Gaudapada says, this shows that the experiencer in waking state, in dream state, and deep sleep state is the same. But experienced, seen objects, experiences are different. Now, what undergoes changes cannot be real. Because what is experienced in waking state is not experienced in the same manner in dreams, and everything is absent, nothing is present in deep sleep. Therefore, they are not real, but the drashta, the subject, the witness, the experiencer, the seer is the same. Therefore, this reality is one. This reality, when analyzed through the prism of waking state, is called Vishwa. Well, in association with the experiences of dream state, is called Taijasa. In association with the deep sleep state, is called Prajna. These are technical terms. Don't worry, I have already explained in earlier classes. This is only conclusion. In reality, the experiencer remains the same. So the experiencer doesn't belong to any of these three states. See, I can give an example. Suppose There is a structure with three rooms, one built above the other. And if you are the owner of the structure, the building, you will have full freedom to move from one for the first floor to second floor or third floor, as you like. You do not belong to any of the three rooms, because if you belong to any of them, you won't be seen the other place. Since you are present in all the three places, you do not belong to any of the three places. Your status is independent. Your status is not inseparably related to any of the three places. So, at the highest level, we understand that the subject is real. Sri Ramakrishna, from another angle, puts this idea in a very simple illustration. Well, to simplify, I mean, to look at that illustration from another angle, suppose you are staying in a house, your friend comes to the house, and he finds the gate is built of bricks, red bricks. And, well, when he sees the gate from outside, he may find, well, this gate, the opening door, the gate is made of red brick. And then there's a gravel road. Then he finds that also is made of red brick. Then he enters the first floor. Then he finds that floor is also made of red brick. Still, he is not sure about the second and third floors. And when he enters the second floor, then he suddenly realizes it is made of the same brick of which the gate is made. And finally, when he reaches the terrace, he finds everything is made of red brick only. So, the reality is present everywhere, but the reality is independent of all these three states. That reality is the eternal, everlasting Atman or consciousness, the soul. That is Gaudapada's theory. It is called Avasthatraya Vicharaka or Avasthatraya Pratkriya, a particular method of approach which Gaudapada develops in this particular text. The origin of this approach could be found in the two Upanishads of Chandogya and Brihadaranyaka. But it was Gaudapada who, for the first time, developed this approach. If we want to know what we are, we can scientifically and rationally analyze our own inner experiences and then come to a conclusion what we are. If you are the body, well, the body is as good as dead in deep sleep. And that body is different from the body that you associate with waking state. So body cannot be eternal. Mind also. Mind is inactive, inert, unconscious in deep sleep. But it is active in waking and dream states. So we can't be mind. So we are something beyond body, beyond mind, beyond intellect. We are something which transcends all these three states. But that Atman, that consciousness is present in all the three states. But all these three states are only modes of expression of this reality. The reality is beyond all this. That is Gaudapada's theory. This approach he developed in this particular text. Then one special characteristic of this technical book is that Gaudapada wrote this work at a time when the two prominent schools of Buddhist philosophy were very prominent in India. In fact, both of them are still very much active in today's America. One is subjective idealism of Vijnanavada, Yogacara, the other is doctrine of emptiness, which is called Shunyavada. So most of the meditation techniques, the practice of emptying the mind, the practice of mindlessness, the practice of witnessship, conceive of yourself as the witness of everything, not a participant. So all these meditation techniques, relaxation techniques rather, are all offshoots. They are all sprung from two prominent schools of ancient Buddhist tradition, philosophical tradition. One is the subjective idealism, it's called Vijnanavada. The other is the doctrine of emptiness, Shunyavada. Vijnanavada teaches that the external world, external objects are unreal. Everything is momentary. But Vijnanavada also teaches that there is a platform of tendencies and impressions that go through, which is called Alay Vijnanavada. But that is also only relatively permanent, because it is momentary, eternally changing, fleeting sensations and impressions and images. So Gaudapada says, if you argue that external objects are unreal, and if you also argue that what experiences the non-existence of external things is also unreal or momentary, then how do you rationally explain the momentariness of momentary things? Because relativity can only be understood in the context of something which is non-relative. Momentariness of something, of external objects, can be understood only in the context of, against the background of something which is not momentary, which is permanent. Suppose you are traveling in train, both trains are moving at the same speed. You find you are in a static condition. You can't feel the movement of the train which is running close to you. If both the trains are moving at the same speed. If one train is standing, if the other train is moving, then you can feel the movement of the train, the moving train. Similarly, momentariness of external things can be understood only against the background of something which is not momentary, which is eternal. Now, Gaudapada says that eternal reality is Atman, Turiya. So, that reality, which is present in all the three stages of waking, dream, and deep sleep states, still not inseparably associated with these three states. They're associated, but not inseparably, because that reality has got a separate, independent, ontological status. It is eternal witness, the eternal subject. That is Gaudapada's answer. So Gaudapada says, Vijnanavadins or subjective idealists suffer from a very serious flaw from a metaphysical angle, because they are not able to posit one eternal subject and witness. So that's the problem. The second school of philosophy, which was very prominent during Gaudapada's time, was the doctrine of emptiness, which is called Shunyavada. Its greatest exponent was Nagarjuna. The classical work is Madhyamika Karika, sometimes called Mula Madhyama Shastram. Like that, you find these books. These books have got plenty of translations, perhaps. They have been translated into French, German, different languages, especially after the flight of the great Tibetan lamas from Tibet, after the invasion of Tibet by China. A large number of great learned lamas migrated to Europe, mostly to Britain and France, and also to America. They have translated many of these great books, ancient texts from Tibetan or in Sanskrit language into English. So the prominent work of subjective idealist or Vijnanavada is called Yogacara Bhumi, like Lankavatara. There are innumerable books being very great thinkers and philosophers in the Vijnanavada tradition, subjective idealist tradition. Vasubandhu, Dharmakirti, Dignaga, and so on. Now we are talking about Sunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness. So you often find today, it's a very great help in meditation. Meditate on the impermanence of empirical phenomena. That helps you to empty your mind. Because the mind gets occupied. Mind starts suffering strain and pain when it is obsessed with some external objects, or when it is obsessed with some internal sensation. That's the main cause of most of mental conflicts and strains. You're worried about what may happen to you or to another person. You're worried about something that you see, or you may worry about some of hunger, thirst, disappointment, anxiety, melancholy, and so on. So we are worried about external things, and we are worried about internal sensations, emotions and feelings. But if you can concentrate on the momentariness, and finally if you can concentrate on the doctrine of emptiness, you feel a great mental relaxation. So it's a great help, psychologically speaking. But philosophically speaking, Gaudapada points out the doctrine of emptiness has got one serious problem from a logical point of view. See, those who uphold the doctrine of emptiness, they say, at the time of nirvana, spiritual liberation, you feel blissfulness. That's the purpose, in fact. When you meditate, when you empty your mind of all disturbing thoughts and anxiety, you feel a kind of internal relaxation which is called peacefulness, happiness, etc. At the highest level, when this experience becomes a permanent experience, it's called liberation. It's called nirvana according to Buddhist tradition. And then you feel the blissfulness of nirvana, liberation, emancipation. Who enjoys, who experiences this blissfulness at the time of liberation? If everything is empty, subject is empty, object is empty. External things are unreal, we are also unreal. Then, but there should be some reality who enjoys this blissfulness associated with spiritual liberation or nirvana. Gaudapada says it is this Atman. When we realize our true nature, we are not this body or mind or anything. We are the immanent reality, Atman, consciousness present everywhere. The inner reality, the inner resident present everywhere. When we realize our transcendental nature, then sufferings, losses, problems associated with daily life, hunger or thirst, anger, disappointment, all these will not affect us. Because we go beyond it. We don't negate it, we go beyond it. Negation is different from transcending. When we transcend the lower identities, like I am the body, I am the mind, etc., then we feel permanent, eternal happiness and joy. That joy is not momentary joy. It is a state of blissfulness which makes you feel there is nothing more to be achieved. There is nothing more to be attained. That's a real sign of spiritual growth. You may work. You may be working for a definite goal, something to be achieved. You may put all your energy and attention, everything. But if you don't get it, it won't shock you. That's a real sign of spirituality. A spiritual person doesn't simply sit somewhere and without doing anything. In fact, there is a feeling and there is a wrong notion. In fact, that idea was sometimes presented as an objection in the commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. I shall give an example to point out this fact. What is the real character of a spiritually liberated person? I gave this example. I took the example from Bhagavad Gita, second chapter. The last 18 verses of the second chapter constitute a description of the characteristics of a spiritually illumined soul. Siddha Prajna Lakshanani is called. So there is a picture of a spiritually liberated person, a person who has attained nirvana. Apuryamanam achalapradishtam samudramapa pravishandi yeddu tadukamayam pravishandi sarve sa shantim apnodi na kama kami. See, the last part of this sloka verse is saha shantim apnodi. He or she attains peace. The peace you should write with capital letter P. It is not a peacefulness in a very empirical or phenomenal sense. It's not in empirical sense, in transcendental sense. So who attains peace? The picture is given. You have to think of an ocean, and innumerable rivers, hundreds of rivers, empty their waters into that ocean. The ocean remains totally undisturbed. The ocean doesn't block the rivers. No, don't come and disturb me. No. The ocean doesn't go out and invite the rivers, please bring your waters to me. No. The ocean remains undisturbed. The ocean is not inactive because it accepts, it welcomes the rivers. It doesn't block their flow. But it doesn't get overflowed. It's not affected. It doesn't seek, it doesn't avoid. So a spiritually enlightened person will be extremely humanistic in his approach. He will not become insensitive. He becomes sensitive in a higher spiritual sense. He may work for the good of all. He may put all his energy and time, everything, for the good of others. The only difference is he or she is not affected. Now, Gaudapada says, if the doctrine of emptiness is a sound system of philosophy, a logical approach, then the question arises as to who enjoys this blissfulness associated with nirvana. Gaudapada says, at the time of liberation, according to Advaita Vedanta, we realize the fact that we are the all-pervading consciousness, the eternal spiritual reality, which is present in everything, in an amoeba and also in a Buddha. See, Swami Vivekananda's famous statement is that the difference between an amoeba and Buddha is not one of degrees, but one of degrees. The difference between an amoeba and Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. In amoeba, this consciousness, this Atman is manifesting in a low degree. In a Buddha, literally in Sanskrit, Buddha means the enlightened one. Buddha could mean Jesus, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, any spiritually enlightened person. That's the meaning of Buddha. Buddha means the enlightened one. So in a spiritually enlightened person like Buddha, this Atman manifests in his full effulgence. Now, Gaudapada says, at the time of liberation, we feel that we are one with the whole creation. We are one with the entire humanity. So that is the earlier part of the text which Gaudapada deals with. Now, towards the end, in the fourth chapter of the book, Gaudapada establishes his doctrine of non-origination that I already mentioned earlier. To expound this idea, he gives the illustration, the simile, which is called the fire circle simile, Alata Chakra. Alata means a fire, a torch. Suppose you are holding in your hand a lighted torch. If you go on rotating the torch creates a fire circle. And you feel you are holding in your hand a wheel made of fire. But the moment you start rotating slowly, that wheel, the circle, vanishes. Similarly, names and forms and sensations, all these moving one after another, create the impression that there is this world. In reality, if you look at the true nature of this world, if you dissociate the world from name and form, from its associated names and forms, then you can live in the world, look at the world, still without seeing the world. Instead of seeing the world, you'll be experiencing the all-pervading reality. This can be made clear from another example. Suppose you have before you a large number of different types of golden ornaments made of the same gold. Rings, maybe necklaces, innumerable types of golden ornaments in innumerable shapes, sizes, and forms. When we go to a jewelry shop, we may select the ornament on the basis of the shape and form and so on. But suppose you take different ornaments to a goldsmith. He will judge these things only on the basis of the quality of gold of which these ornaments are made. Because he may melt all these and make it gold, again he may make different things. Or if you go to a pot maker, you carry with you different utensils made of clay. The pot maker may judge these utensils only, and then he will say, oh, it's all clay only. So if you can look at this world without depending upon the prism of name and form, the relativity, what you call name, forms, and causation, the three dimensions of relativity, then you find you are not living the world, you can experience the world to be non-different from the absolute reality. Nama rupa drishtya mithya surupa drishtya brahma eva. It's a famous statement in Vedanta. When you associate these things, names and forms, with names and forms and shapes and utility, it is a world. This world is a source of pain and conflicts and problems. On the other hand, the same world, you can live in the same world, look at the same world, experience the same world, and be part of this world without suffering, without anxiety, without conflicts, because the world is non-different, the same absolute reality, which means the world has not taken birth. The absolute reality is never reborn. The absolute reality never takes the form of this world. So sometimes called the ontophenomenology of consciousness, sometimes it's called approach. This is Gaudapada's approach. So it is a very unique text. There is a great misunderstanding sometimes. It is very natural. See, we are being taught that the world doesn't exist. It is very difficult to understand. Now, what does really mean? The world has no reality. What does it mean? I already explained this earlier. In Vedanta, whatever is changing is not real in the absolute sense, it is only relative. To be called absolutely real, It should remain the same without any change in the past, present, and future. It should not come into existence, because coming into existence, called birth, is a transition or a change from a state of non-existence to a state of existence. Growth, evolution, decay, death, all these are changes. So anything which belongs to time is non-eternal. Anything which is beyond time is eternal. The world certainly belongs to time. It is within time. The world perhaps did not exist the way it is existing several millions of years back. And maybe after several millions of years, it may not exist the way it is existing now. Which means it's relative as an insect, which may take birth now and may exist for a few minutes and then vanish. Bacteria or any of these things, insignificant. These nano creatures, sometimes they're called small things. They come into existence, exist for a few minutes and vanish. World comes into existence, exists for several millions of years and vanish. Both belong to time. So Gaudapada says, Vedanta says, this is relative. Then what is not relative, what is absolutely real? It is the eternal, everlasting consciousness, Atman. As the inner reality within all of us, it is called Atman. As the all-pervading, omnipresent reality, it is called Brahman. That is Gaudapada's theory. So all the problems we are facing now are because we identify ourselves with what we are not. We are in reality the eternal, changeless, ever blissful Atman, consciousness. But we identify ourselves with everything else. Everything other than what we really are. That is Gaudapada's theory. So Vedanta, in that sense, remember, Vedanta comes as a great consolation to people living right in the midst of all of us. Even as an intellectual theory, it has a soothing effect. Because mostly people suffer conflicts and melancholia, and they commit suicide, they take drinks and drugs, all because they think the problems they are facing are eternal problems. And the sources of the problems are also eternal. The moment they realize that the problems they are facing are not eternal, their causes are also not eternal. The only eternal reality is something else. Then they will not go out of their way either to create problems for themselves or for others, or take resort to undesirable means to run away from themselves. People want to run away from themselves, run away from their own memories, disturbing memories and conflicts. Momentary forgetfulness, that's what everybody is seeking. Gaudapada says the only solution to this problem is to remind ourselves of what we really are. Sometimes people ask the question, this is a wonderful idea, but how to experience this? Well, even if we have not fully experienced this, even as an intellectual conviction, it can be great help. We may forget this, but again and again, if we remember by reading, by listening to these ideas, by contemplation, can become a source of great help and guidance in our day-to-day activities. So we have a few minutes, since this is the last class of this text. You can ask any questions that you would like to ask, clarification or anything. There will be, I should announce, this is the last class before the winter recess. The next class will be on Friday, March 14th. 2014, because I would be away for several months. So if you want, we can have an active discussion. We have got 10 minutes. Either based on what I said today, or generally speaking on this text, or on a general basis, you can raise your points. Yes. The Gaudapada's approach is called the approach of analyzing the absolute reality on the basis of the three states of consciousness in our daily experience: waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. Each state is called avastha in Sanskrit. Avastha traya means the three state. Avastha traya vicharya means the approach in Vedanta on the basis of the three states of human consciousness. Sometimes it is called avasthatra prakriya, a particular approach, methodology in Vedanta. In Vedanta, there are innumerable approaches and methodologies. This is one of them. And this is a celebrated one. And it was Gaudapada who, for the first time, historically speaking, who expounded this idea. So the approach is purely psychological. Gaudapada doesn't ask you to go to a place and worship and pray. Gaudapada doesn't object that. He is all for going to a temple, pray. He is a great supporter. But he says, even from a purely logical point of view, you can establish the reality of Vedanta. That's something very interesting. Gaudapada's approach is purely based on logic and rational thinking. There is absolutely no theological burden in this. That's a uniqueness of this approach. Purely rational. He will be very happy to meet modern atheists and agnostics. He will consider them to be good food for him. Because his approach, Gaudapada's Kariga, commented upon by Shankaracharya, is a unique philosophical work, the original work. It abounds in different psychological and philosophical ideas and approaches, purely based on logical, he says. Yes. Now, there's a minor difference in approach. See, Gaudapada emphasizes the idea of non-origination, the non-reality of the world. Shankaracharya emphasizes not only the absolute reality of Brahman, but he also points out the relativity of this world. The world is relatively real. That point is very clearly accepted by Shankaracharya. Gaudapada's point is the world is only relatively real. Shankaracharya says the world has got a relative existence. So in there is a celebrated sentence in Shankaracharya's commentary Bhashya. Prag Brahmatma Vijnana Sarva Loka Vivakaranam Satyattu Upapattihi Yadha Swapna Drishti Seva Prak Prabodhat. When I explain this statement, you will understand the implication of what I was telling earlier. Here, Shankaracharya says, just as before you wake up from a dream, dream objects are real to you, similarly, these worldly experiences are real, or we should consider them as if they are real, before you realize Brahman. So, see, Shankaracharya's system is more compact. It is a full-fledged metaphysical edifice. Gaudapada's system is not so comprehensive. He takes up one aspect of Advaita Vedanta and he emphasizes that point. So, see, Shankaracharya, he says, what he says, before you realize the supreme reality, before you become a knower of Brahman, you have to live in this world. You have to do your work, duties and responsibilities without desire for the results. You should practice Nishkama Karma, the yoga of disinterested action. And then when you realize the supreme reality, you can go beyond this. Before that, you have to work hard by practicing disinterested action, karma yoga. Gaudapada doesn't bother about that. Gaudapada sits on the top of the hill and proclaims the conclusion of Vedanta. Shankaracharya takes you by your hand and makes you climb the hill and takes you to the top. That's all. Gaudapada doesn't lend a ladder for others to climb. He declares it from the top. But Shankaracharya, he provides you a ladder and takes you step by step to the top. That's the difference. Nikhilanandaji's translation is fully based on Shankaracharya's interpretation.
Karika is Shankaracharya's interpretation of the Karika also.
Yes, Nikhilanandaji has given a translation of Shankaracharya's Karika Bhashya. See, Shankaracharya is not the author of Karika, he is the author of the Bhashya on the Karika, which was written by Gaudapada. So, Karika itself is a commentary on the Upanishads. So, perhaps Nikhilanandaji's translation is the most dependable and perhaps the best translation of Shankaracharya's Bhashya. It is a complete translation of Shankaracharya. He put notes. And after writing this, he got it edited by great traditional scholar like Subramanayyar and many C. Subramanayyar, who was a prominent Gaudapada specialist of that age. So, it still continues to be the best translation of Karika Bhashya. Any other otherwise? Yes. In fact, whatever we do with a strong motive creates a block in our spiritual path. Whatever we do without a desire for the results removes that block. So that's our daily experience. When we do things without a motive, with great concentration, slowly our mind elevates, and along with that, if we keep reading these ideas, the truth of these ideas, the relevance of these ideas become more and more obvious to us. So Karma Yoga is the first step. In fact, Gaudapada doesn't bother much about different approaches towards realizing this ideal. But in Shankaracharya's books, he gives relevance to the problems of common seekers, the beginners, the students, and he is more broad-minded in that respect. So, Karma Yoga is the first step and very logical step. So I will conclude. Before that, again, once more, I'm reading the announcement. This is the last class before the winter recess. The next class will be on Friday, March the 14th, 2014. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna.